Morning, we have one case set for argument, and so we'll go ahead and jump right in. Call for announcements and call the case, State of Texas and Texas Association of Business, et al. Versus the City of Austin et al. Calls number 18445CV. Can we have announcements from the lawyers, please?
Robert Kennedy with Project Collins here and ready.
Andrew Davis for the state here and ready.
Mr. Davis.
Paul Matula here for the Appalachians Cross Collins, the City of Austin, and City Manager Spencer Croft.
Mr. Matula. Very well. Good morning to all of you. For those of you who may be new to the third court, each side is allocated 20 minutes to argue. I understand that you all have a rather complex division of time, and so we will look to you all to stand at the podium when it's your time to go. I understand you've gotten with our clerk and let her know how we're going to split up time, and so we should be all set there. As you will recall, there is a warning system. When the yellow light comes on, you have 2 minutes remaining in the given time that you're within. When the red light comes on, you need to look to the court because you're out of time. We also, maybe since some of you have argued, have installed an audio system that will record the arguments. Arguments will be posted to the court's website and be able to be downloaded. And so the microphones are on and you will be recorded. Also, by way of housekeeping, if anyone in the audience has a cell phone, pager, or other device that might go off and disturb our litigants, now would be a good time to reach down and turn it off. And with that, we will hear from the attorneys. Mr. Davis.
May it please the court, Andrew Davis for the state. The City of Austin enacted an ordinance that the state legislature forbid it from enacting. The legislature told cities that local ordinances are preempted to the extent that they establish or govern wages. Nevertheless, the city enacted and plans to enforce an ordinance that effectively raises wages by requiring employers to pay employees more for the same amount of work. Now, people obviously disagree about whether preempting paid sick leave ordinances is good policy, but a preemption claim is not a policy debate. The legislature enacted provisions preempting paid sick leave ordinances, and this court should enforce them. Allowing the city to disregard state law by enforcing its ordinance would undermine the state's sovereignty and would upend our constitutional structure. The only real dispute regarding preemption is whether an ordinance requiring employers to pay employees sick leave by working is an ordinance that establishes a govern or is whether this governs or establishes a wage.
Mr. Davis, before we jump off into the preemption argument, would you please address the state's or the city's argument that the state lacks standing somehow to intervene into this case?
Certainly. The state has plain standing here. The three prongs of standing are injury, causation, and redressability. Here, the state is injured because it has it will suffer a harm to its state sovereignty and the constitutional structure. The Attorney General and the state are responsible for defending the state's law and the state's constitution. That's a constitutional mandate. It's also in the statutes. And if the ordinance is allowed to go into effect and contradict state law, that is a harm to the state's law, and the state has an interest in defending that. Now, the ordinance obviously causes that harm because it's what is being enforced, and it's enforced by the city. So a declaratory judgment stating that this is unconstitutional will redress that injury from the state.
Does the standing depend on the preemption argument being correct?
No, that's a merits question. Of course, we are at a temporary injunction stage at this point, but it is a merits question about preemption. Now, there could be, if there's sort of no merit to it or it's legal on its face, that could get to a jurisdictional question. That is something, obviously, the state makes clear in many cases that a claim that is facially invalid doesn't waive jurisdiction. But because we have a valid claim, that establishes a waiver of jurisdiction. But that's independent of standing itself, which is a different inquiry.
What about under the text of the UDJA? You know, we're used to seeing the state come in and defend state statutes. Does the text of the UDJA give the state the ability to come in and defend against a challenge or a challenge to a municipal ordinance like this?
Certainly, Your Honor. The text of the UDJA says that if a statute or ordinance is alleged to be unconstitutional, the Attorney General is entitled to be heard. So there's nothing in the text of the statute which limits the Attorney General to coming in whenever the whenever it's coming in as a defendant. Now, granted, that is how the state has often come in to these things, because oftentimes it is a state statute that's being attacked, and the state has a duty to come in and defend that state statute. But the fact that it says ordinance suggests that the state could be on either side of that. A preemption claim has been is a frequent claim. The Supreme Court, you know, 2 terms ago in BCCA, last term in City of Laredo, the state has a strong interest in ordinances that violate the Constitution through preemption. So it has this interest, and it's entitled to be heard. And the case law
was the state an intervener in the bag ban case?
We participated as an amicus in that case. And what's clear about this is the entitlement to be heard is more than amicus, because the Attorney General can certainly participate as an amicus in a case, and it does, and the bag ban case is a perfect example of that. But it's not limited to that, because it has the ability to participate as an amicus, as any other party, or, I mean, party, but
apparently lots
entity.
Of people have the ability to participate as amicus in this case.
that is quite true, Your Honor. What the text does, saying entitled to be heard, is it ensures that the state can do more than participate as an amicus. And cases such as Sevcik, and I think we cite a few more on page 12 of our opening brief, show that the state can come in. Entitlement to be heard is the ability to become a party, and there's no restriction on that becoming as a plaintiff or as a defendant.
Thank you.
Turning to the merits, or at least whether there's a probable right to recovery here, the ordinary definition controls in this case, because the definition of wage is not defined. And the court, meaning the Supreme Court of the U.S. as well as the Texas Supreme Court, often looks to Black's Law Dictionary as a example of what is how to define a legal term. Now, here, paid leave is specifically included in the definition, and it has been since the time that this act was passed on through to today. And that is because paid leave has two of the core aspects of what makes a wage. Now, the two core aspects, they don't have to both be there for something to be a wage, but when they are both there, that means that it is almost certainly a wage because it is at the core. And those two attributes are payment in money to the employee for services rendered. Now, here it's undeniable that this is money in the hands of employees. They receive more money in their paycheck. It has to be reported to the IRS as wages. And it's for services rendered. The ordinance specifically says that paid leave is earned. It refers throughout the ordinance to earned sick leave. It's tied to the amount of work that an employee does for the employer. Now, the city wants to argue that this is a benefit, not a wage, but that's because there are two pieces to paid leave. There's the benefit of time off, and then there's the wage of the payment. And that can be shown through the fact that take, for example, what could be going on without the ordinance. Employers can create their own leave programs, and they may not need to pay for them. They provide their employees with leave time, but don't pay. Or they could pay less than what their employer normally, what they normally pay. They could pay $5 an hour or $10 an hour to someone who ordinarily earns 20. But the statute, the ordinance here, under 419.2J, specifically says that they have to pay the wage that they would ordinarily be paid. It robs them of discretion to pay what they want or not pay at all, and that's how it sets a wage. I see my time has expired.
Let me ask you a question before you sit down. The one thing that isn't really addressed in the briefing, but I'm just curious about it. It looks like to me 620515, you know, says establishing a wage, whereas 62151 says anything governing wages. Is it possible that you have preemption under one but not the other? In other words, could 62151 be preemptive but not 620515?
The best reading of those is that they have the same scope. And that is because the goal was to create uniformity. And the history of the statute, these provisions were added late in the 2000s. The history of the statute recognized the difference between FLSA employers and non-FLSA employers. And that sort of worked through time as a difference. And then these preemption provisions were sort of slotted into that, which is why you have two different preemption provisions. So that explains why they're different. And so I recognize that they say establish, but it's also important in 62.0515 that the end of that, it still mentions that the provision governing wages, so it still uses the same term. So it's plain that they were meant to be read together, but to the extent that they could be, that 0515 established could be read more narrowly, it still meets it here, because as explained, it establishes a wage by saying specifically what the wage is that has to be paid. It's the wage that the employee ordinarily gets paid, not some other wage that the employer wants to pay.
And let me pose one quick question. Given the posture of this case, denial of the temporary injunction, and we are looking at a question of abuse of discretion on the part of the trial court, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
And so then, given the given that the issue before us in some large part is the definition of wages, what do you perceive your burden to be then in dealing with the question before us, which is, did the trial court abuse its discretion? Are you almost not facing a burden to establish as a matter of law the definition that you proposed to us?
So an abuse of discretion standard still has, if there's a legal question on an abuse of discretion standard, the legal question is still properly at issue, and it's reviewed without discretion in terms of how the law is understood. The discretion has to do with the facts and the understanding and whether the trial court is feels it appropriate to enter the injunction. So on the probable right to relief, that is a pure legal question that has no possibility for the development of facts. It's simply a statutory interpretation question. So there's no deference that needs to be sort of afforded to the trial court in that. Where the deference would come in would be if you had factual development and the trial court was, you know, hedging its bets or understanding or trying to look into the future and understand what was going to be developed there. It would have discretion about whether or not to enter the injunction, given sort of the equities of the matter. Again, here we don't think that's really at issue because the state has a clear harm that's established by law. But that's how the abuse of discretion standard would apply here. It's a legal question as to preemption. And if there's a probable right to relief the trial court found otherwise, that would be an abuse of discretion as a legal issue.
One more question, since you appear to be the preemption guy. Is there any sort of preemption under the FLSA, federal preemption, that plays into this or that we should consider at all?
No, Your Honor. The FLSA applies, and the statute specifically says that under 62.151, that this chapter, meaning the entire thing, and a municipal ordinance, does not apply to a person covered by the FLSA. So that sort of takes the FLSA and says the FLSA governs if it governs. If the FLSA doesn't govern, that's when state law applies.
So the state statute, the Minimum Wage Act, kind of specifically carves out FLSA. Does a municipal ordinance, or do we rely on the state statute language in, what is it, 62.151, to take the FLSA off the table with regard to this ordinance?
I want to be careful with take off the table, because obviously the FLSA still applies to any employer who's governed by the FLSA. What the state law does is it says, you know, we have different provisions within the Texas Minimum Wage Act. It basically takes the calculation for the Minimum Wage Act from the FLSA, but there are some differences. The FLSA does more than just the minimum wage. That's not put into the statute. The Texas Minimum Wage Act has some reporting requirements that aren't in the FLSA, so they're different. So there are provisions that apply only to non-FLSA employers, but to the extent the FLSA applies, it applies without regard for state law, in the sense that, one, because of preemption, but that's not really an issue here, because 62.15 already carves out and says we're not trying to govern those employers.
Okay, thank you. Morning, Mr. Haneke.
Good morning, Mr. Chief Justice. May it please the court, Justice Perrier, Justice Field, good morning. It's a privilege to be here with you here today. First of all, on behalf of the appellants, we join in the state of Texas in the argument that preemption controls is dispositive, and it is dispositive in this case, not only on the likelihood of the merits and the issue of the temporary injunction. We believe that it's also dispositive ultimately as to the merits. By way of introduction, here where I stand, in the unique role of representing the employers and business in the state of Texas. And what's unique about this case is the unanimity in the wide spectrum of employers that have come into this court asking for relief, everything from representatives of the largest employers, the membership in the Texas Association of Business, coalition of small businesses that are here through the National Federation of Independent Business, individual business owners like Kelly Hudson, who's the owner of Leading Edge, who spent his life work building up a temporary staffing company to give first chance employment opportunities for individuals. And then even the smallest employers like Strickland Christian School, which exists to provide affordability, quality Christian private school education here in Austin.
You're not suggesting we need to get off into the policy merits behind the law and whether it's good and bad, are you?
No, sir. No, sir, because these are pure legal questions. But the businesses are here because of the legal issues, and that it's not the proper role of the City of Austin to step in as the chief executive office in mandating business practices within those employers. First of all, there's not a evidence-based legitimate governmental interest in the record for the city to do so. And second, they run full square into the protections and rights that are guaranteed under the Texas Constitution. So in the likelihood of success of the merits, I also want to focus on the constitutional issues that the private appellants have raised, that each of them also provide a separate basis for temporary injunctive relief. They present clear legal issues supported by sufficient evidence and a factual record, at least in terms of likelihood of success on the merits. And the determination here not only will be dispositive on the temporary injunction issue, but will also provide guidance on the law of the case that I think will streamline matters for when this matter may ultimately come back on the merits. And the first one that I wanted to focus on that I think is as equally dispositive as the preemption argument are the two issues related to equal protection and freedom of association. You know, if the paid sick leave ordinance goes into effect, our clients representing themselves, their employees, and their members as non-unionized employers and employees in the City of Austin will face a competitive disadvantage with unionized employers because the latter have a right to modify the cap on paid sick leave hours mandated by the ordinance, effectively exempting unionized employers from the ordinance. And in looking into this, we step into the examination under the strict scrutiny framework. Basically, is there a compelling reason for Austin to treat union and non-union shops differently? And the answer is no. The only probative evidence in the record was that the City of Austin lacked a factual basis for this exemption through the testimony of Councilmember Troxclair, and secondly, that this type of exemption violates public policy in Texas. And the Supreme Court of the United States recently reiterated that joining or declining to join unions is expressive activity that's protected by the freedom of association, and that was in the recent Janus case. And, you know, in this case, our clients testified at the temporary injunction hearing that it was an affirmative election of themselves and their employees not to be unionized and to operate that way. And where the City of Austin argues that unionizing is not necessarily a choice, it is the right to not unionize a legally protected status, and also the record in this case is clear that the appellants have elected not to do so. They have elected to not associate in that matter, which is a fundamentally protected right, and if the statute limits that, then we get to strict scrutiny. You know, also in looking at the public policy that also should step in and protect this, that Texas being a right-to-work state dramatically undercuts any purported interest of municipalities to favor unionized workers at the expense of non-unionized ones. Again, that would refute the fact that there could be a compelling governmental interest in providing a regulation that only applies to non-unionized employers but exempts out unionized employers. And therefore, there's no legitimate governmental interest in there. And so the constitutional scrutiny, both for the freedom of association claim and also the equal protection claim based on the freedom of association, should be dispositive in this case.
Mr. Henneke, help me make sure I understand the ordinance. How does it operate in the situation of a company, you know, say a big company like a Dell or somebody that already pays a host of these type of sick leave wages? How does the state, the ordinance here operate? Non-unionized, big company that already provides the benefit.
So to the extent that an employer provides more leave that meets the requirements of the City of Austin ordinance, given that many employers who provide leave don't do and so in the way that's mandated by the city, but if presumably you had a large employer that provided more than the minimum number of paid sick leave hours and would allow for them to be used in the manner it's set forth by the city, then the ordinance provides for employers to provide more than that. And those employers would not be really at issue or dispute here because their policies that they have freely adopted already put them beyond or in addition to the limits or the requirements of the City of Austin ordinance.
As a matter of practice, would they have to file something to show that, or would it be an employee bringing a complaint that would trigger the city looking into their policies?
It could be triggered by a complaint. The statute is silent in terms of, I guess, self-reporting of compliance. You do have reporting requirements that require employers to have to provide documentation to their employees in terms of accrued leave. Potentially, you would still have an interference in the operations of these major employers who would have to prove that they were otherwise not subject to the specific requirements because they provide more.
Are you aware of a case, excuse me, to point us to that where there's a similar exemption for unionized business versus non-unionized business and the constitutional underpinnings of that?
I'm not. And the authority that was cited by the city in their brief is not on point either, because none of those talk to a naked distinction between unionized versus non-unionized employers. We have, you know, the constitutional recognition that the right not to unionize is equally protected under the freedom of association. But I'm not aware, certainly here in Texas, of where this type of overreach by the government in only targeting non-unionized employers has been presented to a court as a freedom of association issue.
So it's your understanding of the ordinance that a unionized employer could hire a part-time worker and completely opt out of paying them the paid sick leave?
So the opt-out provision applies to the number of hours that an employer is required to provide. Where a unionized employer, an employer agreed to a collective bargaining agreement, may modify the cap on the hours, and there's no minimum or maximum limit on the modification. So presumably under the ordinance, a unionized employer could modify the cap to zero, and under that policy would be compliant with the City of Austin regulation, whether that was for a part-time worker or a full-time worker. And that type of difference then, so in that terms, this regulation really only applies to non-unionized employers, because any unionized employers have the ability to go below or even to zero the thresholds that are set by the city. And when they do so, it effectively exempts them out from any of the burdens or requirements in the ordinance. You know, to be able to offer zero paid hours to be compliant doesn't really create a requirement on that. One of the things I did want to touch on, judges, in the imminent injury and ripeness, this ordinance is supposed to go into effect October 1st. We're beyond that point in time. In the record, there is the evidence of the burdens of pre-compliance costs, also the burdens of compliance costs and burdens once this goes into effect, not just in terms of money, but also in terms of competitive disadvantage. Certainly that's ripe for, as if this court were to rule against us, the ordinance would presumably then immediately be in effect. And so this is an immediate and ripe controversy. And as far as the irreparable injury, there is a clear abuse of discretion where irreparable injury is per se. And there's two ways in our briefs where we address how the clear abuse of discretion results in a finding of irreparable injury, both in the infringement on constitutional rights, and also in the lack of adequate remedy at law based on the sovereign immunity bar of recovery of costs if this ordinance is eventually struck down. Thank you, Your
Honors.
Thank
you, Mr. Henneke. Mr. Matula, good morning.
Good morning, Justice Rost. May it please the court. This case that the plaintiffs filed was filed too early. It was filed before the facts had played themselves out, such that they would sufficiently develop a picture that would demonstrate for the trial judge that the plaintiffs met their burden to establish the three elements that would entitle one to the extraordinary remedy of a temporary injunction. There were strategic reasons why the plaintiffs filed the case when they did. These are discussed in some of the materials that were introduced at the hearing, including one of the emails that the city offered in. But the strategic decision to bring this case when they did, prior to enforcement, prior to the effective date of the ordinance itself, created very real insurmountable problems as to rightness, which is a jurisdictional issue.
If there's a valid preemption claim, does the rightness argument you make still hold?
I would argue that the preemption claim is invalid on its face. However, I would concede that the court obviously rejected that argument in denying the plea to the jurisdiction as to the claims brought by the plaintiff. But Justice Puryear, I think as you noted, what is really before the court in this particular review, at least so far as the temporary injunction piece of it goes, is whether or not the trial judge, Judge Shulak, committed a clear abuse of discretion. And as the court understands, that is a very high bar to cross, because when it comes to matters of temporary injunctions, trial judges are afforded a great deal of discretion. The reviewing court recognizes that discretion and cannot substitute its own judgment, even if it believes the decision was in error or was wrong. To reverse the temporary injunction decision, the appellants or the court must conclude that the records before the court clearly establish that the trial judge acted unreasonably, arbitrarily, and without reference to any rules, or any guiding rules or principles. In other words, that a trial court could not have reasonably reached any other decision but to grant the temporary injunction in this case. As the state admits in its opening brief, it is very rare to present a record that establishes that.
And the record again, though, in this case, if there is a valid preemption claim as a matter of law, does the trial judge have the discretion to get that wrong?
I believe the judge has the discretion to make the determination that a valid preemption claim has not been shown by the plaintiffs to probably result in the relief that they are seeking, which is the second requirement that a plaintiff must plead and prove in order to receive a temporary injunction. So to answer your question, the trial judge could have concluded that the preemption claim, while valid, failed to meet the other two requirements under the Butinaro case with regard to probable right to relief and probable imminent irreparable injury.
How do you distinguish the SO versus University of Texas case in terms of ripeness? That's the case where University of Texas was trying to strip a PhD from a former student, and the university's argument was that it wasn't ripe because she brought it before her PhD was in fact stripped, and she said, no, I've got a Declaratory Judgment Act claim that you don't have the authority to hold a hearing about a former student, and we held she was correct. How do you distinguish those facts from the situation we're in here?
Judge, honestly, I'm not familiar with the case and am not prepared to answer the court's question regarding the distinctions. I'd be happy to provide some briefing after the hearing to give our explanation on that particular case.
That'd be great.
Okay.
Thank you.
I think part of the concept there was a concept of ripening seeds of controversy, you know, that the controversy doesn't have to be fully on the vine.
Well, to that particular point, as the court understands, the fruit does not necessarily have to be on the vine, but it has to at least sprout it. And in this particular situation, what they're trying to do is attack an ordinance that not only hasn't been enforced against anyone, certainly hasn't been enforced against the plaintiffs, but it is not even effective yet. And due to that fact, there is not a history of how that particular paid sick leave ordinance is going to play out. There's been a great deal of speculative testimony that was presented at the hearing from the witnesses about what they thought might happen, how employees might use their accrued paid sick leave, costs that they believe they might incur in order to comply with the ordinance.
But is there any doubt that it was going to be implemented and that it would be enforced and that there would be consequences if businesses did not comply?
There was no doubt, Justice Perrier, that the ordinance was going to be become effective on October 1st of this year. But the way the ordinance was written, of course, the employers and employees were obligated to comply with the ordinance in the event if they were covered. But the way the ordinance was written, there was not an enforcement penalty against an employer for a violation of the ordinance until, I believe, June of 2019. And that was for most employers. And the enforcement mechanism didn't kick in under the ordinance for smaller employees until June of 2020, I believe.
Was there not significant evidence presented regarding the extent to which businesses had to prepare for this in terms of setting up benefits administrators and possibly altering their business model to account for employees that might be out using their new benefit? There were steps necessary to prepare for implementation. Was there not significant evidence presented about that?
There was significant evidence presented at the hearing that some efforts would have to be undertaken in order to comply with the ordinance. There was not clear evidence with regard to what the actual out-of-pocket cost would be for those particular efforts. Notably, the witnesses, the two business owner witnesses, Mr. Rigdon and Mr. Hudson, testified that they really hadn't spent any money at all in anticipation of getting ready for the ordinance. The only thing they had done is sued the city.
But I guess my point is these businesses could not wait until October 1st and then begin to take steps to deal with this new regulatory burden that they're confronted with.
That is correct, Your Honor. They would be ill-advised to wait until the start date before they prepared to comply with it. But the things that they testified about regarding what they had to do to prepare, in the case of Mr. Rigdon at the school, that school already offered paid leave to its employees. And his testimony was that the paid sick leave under the city ordinance would provide those employees with just about the same amount of paid leave that they were already getting. They already had someone in place who could keep track of the accrual and use of that leave. So there's no real associated cost with that. He did testify that, yes, we would have to prepare for it and explain it to our people and get ready to comply. But that's the thing that any business is going to have to do, and any business owner is responsibly going to do in order to make sure that they comply with the statute.
So it sounds as if you're effectively conceding that, yes, there was a period of time prior to implementation date where this matter is fully ripe for consideration, given that the conduct of the affected businesses is going to be altered, in that they're now having to take steps that they would not be taking but for the implementation of this ordinance.
I agree that the evidence did establish at the hearing that they were going to have to do some things in order to get ready to comply with the statute. But as the court wrote in the Atmos Energy versus Abbott case, when a facial challenge of this sort is made against a ordinance, or in that case a law, the one of the focuses on the ripeness issue is whether or not complying with a law or ordinance that has not been enforced yet, that involves an evaluation of whether or not those activities require a plaintiff or a person covered by the ordinance to significantly change their way of doing things. The evidence presented at the hearing suggested that the school, for instance, really didn't have to do a whole lot because the school already offered paid leave to its employees. Yes, they were going to have to figure out how the mandatory paid leave under the ordinance was different from the paid leave that their employees already accrued. But that didn't involve a tremendous amount of cost that would impact their ability to carry on their chosen profession of running a school. With respect to the other witness, Mr. Hudson, his testimony about the things he would have to do is he thought that he might have to hire a specific individual who would be in charge of administering the paid sick leave under the ordinance. In other words, an administrative type person. But his testimony on that was that that's something he chose to do. It was a business decision in his view. It's certainly not something that the ordinance required him to do. Apparently, he believed that that's what he thought he might need to do to make sure that the tracking and the accrual and the bookkeeping part of it was done correctly. The other part of Mr. Hudson's testimony regarding the things he would have to do was, well, he was going to have to pay employees for time they weren't actually working, which is their characterization of how paid sick leave works. But the example that he testified to the court involved sort of a speculative calculation that he made, that if we took all 460 temporary employees who worked in Austin last year, the minimum number of hours to earn paid sick leave, he thought it would cost his company a little over $50,000 to pay them all one day of paid sick leave. But that's not a very reliable estimate of reality. Because of the nature of their business, these temporary employees, by Mr. Hudson's testimony, only work for that company weeks or months. And it would take 240 hours in order for an individual to work to earn one day of paid sick leave under the ordinance. He testified that his company kept those type of records that would have allowed him to go back and actually do a real calculation based more on reality experience, but he wasn't prepared to do that, and he did not do that when testifying to the court. The court could have concluded without a clear abuse of discretion that that particular testimony did not meet the burden of establishing a probable clear, a probable imminent and irreparable injury, at least to Mr. Hudson's business.
Mr. Matula, I don't want to finish up without you having an opportunity to talk about sort of the merits challenges they make, and in particular preemption. If you want to address their argument on the wages definition and how this case fits.
Your Honor,
in that regard, would you think about a hypothetical, and you can wait and think about it to your rebuttal if you want to, but could the city pass an ordinance saying we recognize traffic in Austin has gotten so bad and we want to encourage people to live downtown and ride their bikes to work. So you employers in the city are going to have to start take an average commute time for each of your employees, and you're going to have to pay them at least minimum wage for that commute time. Would that be a wage under the term used in the labor code that we're discussing here today?
The court is asking if that particular ordinance would require the employer to pay these commuting employees some amount to compensate them for their time in the car. Is that the question?
Correct. Would that be a wage?
I'm not sure whether in that particular scenario that payment would be considered a wage or not. It is clearly something that is measured by the passage of time. It is something that they regularly receive. In other words, they don't have to meet any qualifications in order to get it, unlike paid sick leave, where you have to earn it and you have to qualify for its use. And it would probably depend on whether or not that particular payment is something that the employee was entitled to, even if they were fired. In other words, is it something covered under the Payday Act that they're entitled to on their last day of work?
Okay. So those, in your mind, those are the distinctions that make things a wage. If you have to earn it, for example, you're saying the sick leave policy is different because you have to earn it to accrue the sick time versus someone that you automatically get it if you commute to work. Is that a distinction you're using?
Yes, Your Honor. And to put a better explanation of that distinction, it involves a question of whether or not that individual is actually performing some service to the employer in driving to the work site in terms of commuting. That would be different from a sick leave benefit where an individual is not actually working, is not actually providing a service to the employer. There's no labor being performed. And I don't know the answer to the question about whether in the specific individual's case, whether driving to work would be considered on the clock or off the clock in terms of whether the employee is really providing services or labor. Do they have to have their phone on to answer questions from the office that need their attention? Are they required to monitor a radio that would require them to divert their trip to work to go somewhere else? I think those types of factors would also come into play as to whether or not that would actually be considered a wage rather than a benefit.
Thank you, Mr. Matilla.
Thank you.
Rebuttal, Mr. Davis.
I'd like to jump off on Justice Field, your hypothetical. That would certainly be a wage under the two-prong test that we stated out in earlier, which is that it is paid money for time spent for the employer. Now, my friend wanted to say that the difference here is that paid sick leave is not time spent in the service of the employer, and that's why it's not leave. And then commuting could possibly, depending on different factors. But the fact is that the ordinance specifically and repeatedly refers to this as earned sick time. It is earned because you only get it if you work for the employer for a certain number of hours. It's not simply money that's paid for people not working. It's paid extra, more money for the same amount of work. It's not as if the law simply requires additional payment for not working. It requires that payment only when the person has accrued a certain amount of hours and earned that time. Relatedly, they want to make a distinction about whether or not it gets paid at the end of the employee's time and service. But certainly vacation leave, it may be paid at the end of service, but I know, for example, as a state employee, you can only carry over so much leave in a year. You lose a chunk of it if you don't use it. But of course, if you actually used it and were paid out for it, that would still be a wage. The fact that you don't necessarily get paid if you leave, that's not a distinction. And a good example of setting a wage and establishing a wage is another hypothetical here that I'll give, which is if you have, imagine the city passed a law that said the lowest paid full-time employee of an employer must make at least 1/100th of the highest paid full-time employer. That would be sort of it would not be a specific number, and it wouldn't be across the board every employee has the same thing, but it would still be setting a wage. And that's essentially what the Paid Sick Leave Act here does. It says, look to the employee's wage. They must get that when they earn it by spending at least 30 hours working for the employer. Now, turning to ripeness, it's interesting.
Mr. Davis, can I cut you off on ripeness? Before you leave, I'd like to hear about what exactly you all are asking for in relief. It looked like the briefing was seeking a temporary restraining order. I'm going to assume that's not what you're looking for. What specifically is the relief that the state seeks here?
The state seeks an order that affirms the plea to the jurisdiction denial and that that reverses the trial court's denial of the temporary injunction. I know in Ebony Lake Healthcare versus Texas Department of Human Services, that's not cited in our brief, but it's 62 Southwest 3rd, 867. The court denied the application, the trial court had denied the application of a temporary injunction, and this court remanded the case of the trial court, reversed and then remanded for the trial court to issue a temporary injunction and for further proceedings. That is what we'd be seeking here. For the reversal, the trial court would enter a temporary injunction, proceedings would continue, and we would seek a permanent injunction through due course.
Thank you.
May I turn quickly, or my time, I see my time has expired. And if you want to hear any
questions. Let's go ahead and assume that we understand the ripeness issue, if you'll give us that benefit.
Fair enough, Your Honor.
Okay.
Thank you.
Mr. Matula, I'm going to wrap us up.
Justice Rose, if I may briefly address the preemption issue that you brought up earlier. Very briefly, preemption is strongly disfavored in the law. An ordinance and a law, so long as they can coexist peacefully without stepping on one another's toes, that is a situation where there is not preemption. That's clear in all the case law the Supreme Court has issued on that particular issue. But the legislature knows how to express its intent to preempt. It must do so with unmistakable clarity. That's because cities, home rule cities, are invested with the Constitution with full power of self-rule. Actually, they're the same realm of powers that the state has, which requires a balancing act between states and home rule cities. But that is why it is such a demanding standard for a plaintiff alleging for alleging preemption to establish unmistakable clarity. And I believe the trial judge could have reached the conclusion that that unmistakable clarity to preempt a home rule city's ability to pass a paid sick leave ordinance, that particular intent was not unmistakably clear in the amendments to the Texas Minimum Wage Act. I'd also like to talk briefly about issues of jurisdiction, that is, standing and ripeness. A plaintiff must have standing in order for a court to have jurisdiction, and standing means something that is distinct from that held by the general public. An injury that a plaintiff must establish must be concrete, particularized, actual, and imminent. The injury that the state has described is an abstract idea that its sovereignty is being challenged or attacked by.
How do you address the specific language in the UDJA that gives the state the right to be heard when there's a constitutional challenge to not just a statute, which is what we're used to seeing, but also has a word ordinance in there?
I think that's a very interesting question, and it's one that I struggle with myself and look to other jurisdictions to determine how they handle the particular issue, because it is the Uniform Declaratory Judgment Act. But I think the answer to your question, entitled to be heard, does not mean that automatically gives the state standing to bring an action against the defendant city as a plaintiff. That is because the UDJA does not create jurisdiction. It is only a procedural device for deciding certain issues. The standing must be found somewhere outside of the UDJA. Now, clearly, the Attorney General has the ability to file an amicus brief and does so with some frequency. But I think it's interesting that up until now, they, in these preemption cases where city ordinances are being challenged, I haven't found a lot of authority where they did what they did here, and that is wait until plaintiffs sue, and then they come in as a plaintiff and sue as well. The injury that the state is describing, this attack on its sovereignty, it's an abstract idea that does not establish a real injury sufficient to create a justiciable controversy. The petition that the state filed, petition and intervention, actually did not even satisfy the requirements of the Texas Rule of Civil Procedure. Rule 682 requires that an applicant seeking an injunction must file a sworn petition that sets out in plain and intelligible statement the grounds for the relief sought. The state of Texas never filed any sworn request for a temporary
injunction. Was that objection raised with the trial court?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
Was that an objection that was raised with the trial court?
No, it was not raised at the trial court, and I don't know that it would have mattered so much had they come into court and offered some evidence to substantiate their claim. But they didn't do that. They didn't put on any witness. They didn't put on any evidence. Instead, they relied on the legal argument that by virtue of the fact that this ordinance theoretically, in their view, conflicted with the state law, that that attacked their sovereignty. No one is attacking the state's sovereignty. The state does not have to comply with the ordinance because, as the government, they are exempt from that. Nothing about the ordinance prevents the state from exercising any powers that it has under the Minimum Wage Act, because the Minimum Wage Act really doesn't give the Attorney General or the state of Texas any enforcement powers. That act is enforced by the individuals who are not paid the minimum wage. They've got the right to go to court and seek redress. So it's not a situation where the state is prohibited by operation of the ordinance from doing something that it could otherwise do. That is a lack of standing that deprived the court of jurisdiction and warranted the dismissal of that claim. I see that I'm out of time. If the court has no further questions, I'll end.
Thank you, Mr. Matula. Thank you all for a well-argued case. The court appreciates your guidance. The case will be submitted, and the court will stand in recess. Thank you.